usual sashimi. Just to be sitting at this time when our dear abbot is on her last days was not expected when we planned the sashimi. But these things cannot be planned. There's something about the stability and regularity and form of sashin and our practice in general that's very comforting, even though it's maybe kind of grueling also. It's something dependable, it's something somewhat familiar. So I think that Catherine offering this transition of hers to us, amongst other things, is a call to go beyond the familiar while still staying grounded in the offered forms of our practice. So currently we have a plan to go a little outside the usual form, the sashin, going to sit with Catherine. We're already sitting with her, but sit closer, right next to her breathing body. In the afternoon, we'll go over, we can together silently walk, process over to her house. It's about a 10-minute walk. And sit the first two periods in the afternoon there, and take our sashin there, and other people may be coming and going, and they can join our sashin those two periods, and we can come back here for the last period and service in the afternoon, and then go back to her house after the break in the evening for the last two periods. At least today, let's try that. There's already people sitting zazen over there too, so we can keep the silence of sashin. So if people come by, you can let them know that, and we'll post a sign on the door here. And I thought during this talking time, we can use the opportunity to explore a little bit more about this mystery we call death. This all-important event that's coming through all of us, that's very easy to forget about in the midst of the details of our lives, and a topic that I probably would never occur to me to explore more deeply in a sashin. But since it's topics being offered to us, we can look at it a little bit more, and also continue to look at Catherine's teachings all woven together. So Robert Thurman, many of you may know, as a great American teacher in the Tibetan tradition. I think he was the first American monk ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, later disrobed and now is a university professor. Very, I would call, wild and crazy kind of character. As a personality, he's quite something to meet and listen to, but also a great Buddhist scholar. And he translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and without going into all the Tibetan versions of this. He's just questioning us as Westerners to just look at what we think is going on here. You know, we have these scientific views, and we have Buddhist views. And last night, I think you all were here, you heard Dogen talking about this in-between realm, between lives. So we have this Buddhist tradition. Some people say, well, Zen doesn't get into that stuff. But there we had Dogen, you know, at least briefly, presenting the traditional view in Buddha Dharma. And there's, you know, there's a lot of questioning in modern life. Is that just archaic stuff that was around in Indian culture that the Buddha just accepted or took on as skillful means? And as skillful means, do we, in our modern scientific culture, do we just take on something like nothingness happens at death? Or we just, the body merges with the physical universe, whatever the mind is, dissipates into the universe at large? Or is there some more, you know, what do we make of these traditional teachings about not a self, but a stream of cause and effect that's born into new life, and the possibility of not continuing that, and the bodhisattva vow to actually come back into not necessarily the human world, but to come back into embodiment, not just merged universe, but a specific embodiment in order to help beings. I myself try not to grasp any particular view around these things, but I think that we have the opportunity to explore what our Buddhist tradition and Mahayana tradition and Zen tradition say about this. So Robert Thurman says, "What is death? The question is a scientific one. Western science holds that a flat line on the EEG means cessation of heartbeat and brain activity, and therefore represents death. The illusion of the subjective I in the individual consciousness, assumed by materialists to correspond with the presence of brainwave activity, should cease with the cessation of brainwaves. Yet the picture of death as a nothing in consciousness is not a scientific finding, it's a conceptual notion. There are many cases of people being revived after flatlining for some time, and they report intense subjective experiences. In the popular imagination developed by modern scientific education, death is most often supposed to be a terminal state, a nothingness, an oblivion, a void that destroys life, that swallows it up forever. It's aligned with sleep, darkness, and unconsciousness. It's feared by those who feel happy or feel they should be happy, and it's sought after for those who are unhappy." As in a blessed final anesthesia. But science should not neglect to question this picture. In fact, inner science begins with the analysis of nothingness. Nothing is, after all, just nothing. It cannot be a place that resembles an idea of nothingness. There's nothing there, but we picture, like I will be nothing. Of course, when we start to think about these kind of things, we can't really think about nothingness. But a nothingness cannot be a place that resembles an idea of nothingness, A place involves area or extension. It's defined by coordinates and boundaries. It's not nothing. It's a room. A place is. Nothing has no room, nor can anything be located within nothing. Nothing cannot have an inside or an outside. It cannot destroy, swallow, or terminate. As nothing, it can have no energy or effect. As nothing, it cannot be a thing, a realm, a state, or anything. It's absolutely nothing to fear. It is nothing to hope for. The ultimate end of everything, this diametric opposite of all, is nothing in itself. And yet we think of nothing as something. Clearly nothing is that conceptual entity that shows most clearly the illusory status of all conceptual entities. To use the verb exist about it is a misuse of language, that nothing exists, that there will be nothingness at such a time. To refer to nothing as it, this, that, or whatever is a mistake, as only the concept can be referred to. Nothing is categorically unimaginable, so it's incorrect to picture nothing as a destination. It's wrongly imagined to be a ground state giving off no reading, like an EEG flat line. These are just conceptual ideas from us something beings. It's incoherently imagined to be an anesthesia following all loss of sensation. It's wrongly conceived to be a place of quiet within which consciousness can slip. It cannot be entered. Nirvana also cannot be entered or left. When we imagine nothing in the above ways, we're actually doing nothing more than comforting ourselves. We're building our image of the state of nothingness on our habitual sense of deep sleep. We lose concerns, worries, sensations, and finally consciousness itself as we fall asleep. We fall asleep, having a sense of relaxing into a ground state. We associate sleep with refreshment, rest, peace, and quiet. When we think about these things, it starts to seem, we can start to question the kind of scientific, materialist view of nothingness. Religious ideals of nirvana conceived as a state apart, ultimate liberation from pain and sorrows, or a supreme release, may be nothing but guaranteed states of permanent, gloriously unconscious sleep. This may be how we think of such things. When we see this equation, we can understand at once why materialists scoff at spiritual or religious forms of liberation. Why would they need it? They have already guaranteed themselves permanent rest. They have a guaranteed nothingness waiting for them, attained without the slightest effort on their part, without ethical sacrifice, without realization, without developing any skill or knowledge. All they have to do is fall asleep, a skill they've already cultivated during thousands of nights. But what is it that provides materialists the guarantee of a restful nothing awaiting them after death? Do they have any credible evidence? No one has ever returned to report entry into nothingness. They have no recorder, no viewer, no extension of their senses into the subjectivity of a deceased person. What makes materialists believe so powerfully in the nothingness that one of that one energy continuum? So Robert Thurman says, the answer is obviously that they have no grounds at all for this belief. It's merely a belief based on brave assertion, corroborated by many other believers, all without a shred of evidence reinforced by constant repetition and dogmatic insistence. Of course, they're saying probably that all the religions have the dogmatic insistence that there's something else, a heaven, another life, a pure land. This is materialist dogmatic insistence. It provides ultimate comfort, satisfying the religious urge to have a complete sense of reality. This comfortingness might give rise to suspicion or doubt, so it's disguised for the materialist by the pretense that nothingness is something frightening, something undesirable, a bitter pill that he or she, the brave modern human grown-up, has learned to swallow. This is why materialist scientists are so dogmatically dismissive of evidence about the post-death continuity of consciousness. They cannot consider the evidence, even casually, because this would generate questions about their own belief. Like any religious dogmatism, since it's a logically weak belief, often admittedly irrational, based on no credible evidence, it cannot allow even the slightest questioning for fear that the resulting doubt could not be withstood. In fact, a considerable body of credible evidence supports the probability of post-death existence of consciousness and sentient future life continuity. First, it's the natural thing to expect, since everything else in nature exhibits continuity through changes. Second, many credible witnesses report that they died and experienced certain adventures. Some died clinically and were revived. Some remember as children details and circumstances of former lives, and some of their memories are corroborated by other people standing up to the investigation of reputable researchers. And the majority of humans in most civilizations, they feel they must have some concern for the state of their awareness in the future lives they will be obliged to face. No sane person fears nothingness. It's kind of I thought, wait a second, isn't that actually what we do fear? No sane person fears nothingness. It might be boring, it might not be delightful, but at least it should be restful, peaceful, and painless. And relative to all the troubles of wakefulness, it's pleasant and much sought after by every one of us. What we do fear and should fear rationally are pain and suffering. We work hard in life to avoid pain and suffering. So we're afraid of death, not because we know it is nothing, but because we know in our bones it cannot automatically bring us nothing. I thought that's an interesting point. If you look at it, say like, I'm actually afraid of death, which is probably the case for most people to some extent, because it will be nothing. But he's saying that logically, actually, we can't be afraid of nothing because that's like there's no suffering there. We can't be afraid of suffering of nothingness because that's not there. For even the most diehard materialist, Pascal's famous wager is still compelling. If we become nothing after death, we will not be there to regret having prepared for something. But if we are something after death and we have not prepared at all or are badly prepared, then we will long feel bitter, painful regret. This is Pascal's wager, if I understand it. So we have everything to lose by not being prepared and nothing to gain. We have everything to gain by preparing and nothing to lose. Should our preparation be for nothing, a little time spent on it in this life will not be regretted for eternity. Should our preparation be for something, the time taken away from it for the sake of this life's business or pleasure will be deeply regretted for eternity as the waste of a vital resource. So those of us who have either the prudence or the adventuresomeness to deal with a life situation of total relativity in space and time can safely proceed. There are no boundaries to our interconnectedness with limitless dimensions and universes, and there are no limits to our continuity of development, bad or good. Pascal's wager, because we really can't prove, it seems, what's going to happen here. What are many stories? But it also seems that our preparations, so-called preparations for the end of this life, from the Dharma point of view, are, you know, basically the same preparations for this life. Taking refuge in Buddha, in Buddha nature that's here with us, that doesn't come and go, that's radiantly awake, that at its very essence is total, open, compassionate love, to take refuge in that Buddha, in that Dharma, in that nature, in all beings in the Sangha. As Patrick reminded me, there's a story that Dogen, in his last days of life, was very sick, but apparently he wrote Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha calligraphy and put it on an altar or something and just walked around and around that circumambulating Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And as we heard last night, just continuously taking refuge in Buddha through all kinds of whatever frightening realms are coming to us. Can we take, if we enter nothingness, can we take refuge in Buddha there? Then it's not nothingness, huh? So here's some of Catherine's teaching from 1996. In a sesshin, it looked like in a 5-day sesshin. Maybe this would have been at Jikoji. January 96. She says, when I was younger in practice, when I would feel hopeless about being able to understand, I longed for someone to just tell me what to do. I thought there was a way and I just couldn't find it. Now, years later, I know that practice is the process of realizing there is no way, that each of us is the way. Therein lies the mystery. Which sounds like Buddha. The Buddha way. People, you know, we can read about it and people can tell us about descriptions of Buddha and how to take refuge in Buddha. But in the end, the practice is a processing, is the process of realizing that the way is not this, you know, some limited thing that we think it is, or exactly how it appears in the words, that each of us is the way. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen says, finding your place where you are, settling deeply where you are, is the heart of the path. Not moving is the way. Sesshin instructions. Not moving is the way. This may sound like a contradiction, but a teacher waits for a student to develop confidence in herself, to find what herself is. I had to discover and confess to myself my own judgments and opinions before I could learn that discriminations are illusory. Sometimes we hesitate to name our opinions and values. I had to be willing to own a self before I could drop it. So, something like Buddha nature can sound so extraordinary, and by definition, it's beyond all of our karmic stuff, where it's free from all our karmic stuff, and yet to open to it is right through all our karmic stuff. All our judgments and opinions, we have to really study and watch come and go. Sashin is so great for that. My earliest aspiration, she says, was to be extraordinary. At the same time, I aspired to be ordinary. I came to practice with both aspirations. They coexisted. The vision of an ordinary, simple human life, going to work every day, being a responsible citizen, maybe a parent, was deeply embedded. Simultaneously, the vision of an extraordinary me was also inside. Being extraordinary meant being better than others. Being ordinary meant being one with others. It's taken a long time to realize that practice is not about proving one or the other, but about becoming whole, finding the integration of the two. Which I thought, was very beautiful. Instead of saying, I got over this illusion of extraordinary and just like, it's just about being ordinary, which is kind of maybe her emphasis, but here she's saying, it's the integration of being extraordinary, which of course Catherine is, extraordinary being and ordinary. Finding the integration of the two, becoming whole as ordinary, one with others, the same as others, and extraordinary, not necessarily better, but if we want to even go as far as using that language, we could say better. We're the same as everyone, and we're each better. If we want to take it that far, we're each better than everyone else in the way that we are, right? In being us. Yeah. We're actually the best at being us. I am like the best Kokyo in this room, and Chuck is like the best Chuck in this room. Like, no one, we could try to be like a better Chuck than Chuck, but I don't think so. One of the extraordinary things about Suzuki Roshi was how ordinary he was. It takes time to be willing to be that ordinary. Uchiyama Roshi says, the Bodhisattva is an ordinary person who is walking in the direction of Buddha. That's a great line. The Bodhisattva is an ordinary person who's walking in the direction of Buddha. You could say, like, Buddhas don't take refuge in Buddhas because they are Buddhas, but Bodhisattvas are ordinary beings that are taking refuge in the extraordinariness of Buddha, or walking in the direction of Buddha. This practice of sitting here, letting in our fears, our doubts, our resistances, our denial, is walking in the direction of becoming complete. Letting in these ordinary fears, doubts, resistances, denial, is walking in the direction of becoming complete, or free of ordinariness. Any thoughts, questions, or concerns? requests or pleads for nothingness about this sesshin or this life and this death.
There was a word that I thought was odd for a long time when I was in the military. The word was redeployment.
Redeployment.
Which I thought meant going out to a foreign place again. Your deployment, your redeployment. But actually, what it meant is to reverse deployment. So people who are redeploying are people who are coming back home. And I find that same thing with the word refuge. Right? I think commonly I thought of it as a hiding place. Safe from all the things that scare us and beat us up and stuff like that. But actually it means to quit clinging. Quit going elsewhere.
So re means to quit or just stop?
It means kind of like the opposite of fleeing. So do the opposite of fleeing, which is stay here. Be present. So taking refuge in the Buddha is not like going to the Buddha hotel or the Sangha spa or anything like that. Those are functions. Buddha Dharma and Sangha in terms of functions, they're not things. The function of just resting in that which expresses itself. It can't be expressed. Taking it as unquestionable. It's just the way it is, Dharma. And doing it in relationship with all that is appearing, Sangha, is, I think, what Catherine was saying there. So, being a bodhisattva for me is being aware that I have been in flight. And putting it with what is ordinary, totally natural.
Not flying off somewhere else.
Not being elsewhere. And so,
then can we say that rebirth is coming back to birth, and it's always this birth. Is suffering as the concept of death
it
that
is,
we
it is,
limited
it is a,
thing.
Why make this moment special by calling it something like death or birth? If you want to do that, you're going to suffer. Why not just be the moment? And when I do that, it's great. You know, I go in the middle of total anxiety and remember that and go, oh, there's no anxiety anymore.
Sesshin is a good time for this. Others?
There is a little bit of you've got nothing to lose, do a little preparation now for that thing that may or may not be, you know, on the other side of the common understanding of end of life or what after is. So there's no difference that, as opposed to, you know, John's concept of just kind of withdraw that forward thinking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What's the whiff?
There's something I need to do.
Oh, okay.
There's a frame of mind I need to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, there's a direction that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did love that line of Fujiyama about, you know, Bodhisattva is one, is an ordinary person walking in the direction of Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a doing.
Yeah.
Something that must be cultivated.
Yeah.
That I guess I'm a little uncomfortable with, but I know what it is.
But here we are in Sesshin, right? I mean, we're like, we come, we make effort, and we do this particular, we could be doing anything, but we're choosing to make effort to practice in this particular way. And you could say, the more we get into it, Sesshin is especially like this too, right? The more we get into it, the more we see that it's not different from not Sesshin, right? Sometimes we start to see by the end, it's like this very strange thing that we're in is just the same as the rest of the world. And but to really feel that, it often seems necessary to like enter this strange thing of a Sesshin, or everything is totally, you know, clear and awake and present, but we need these big boulders to remind us. Kind of like, it's like the joke of the universe or something. It's like, we don't really need anything particular, but practically speaking, seems like such. And also, so this word preparation that he's using, that's one that maybe sounds a little funny from a non-dual practice perspective. Preparing? Practice shouldn't be preparing for the future, right? It's just now. So that's what my interpretation of that is, like the preparation for the future or for death is right now just taking refuge in Buddha, which is like not even really doing something. And, you know, we might not be doing it as a preparation, but in fact, from a kind of outside observer, it might seem as if that's actually is creating a preparation for beneficial results in the future. Kind of conventionally speaking. So, you know, ultimately, there's nothing but this moment. Or not even this moment. We can't even call it that. And then conventionally it's like there's practices and, you know, we make a year-long commitment to warming the jewel in time and space with these particular requirements and all that. And because there are effects. And yet, meanwhile, there's just the vast unknown of Buddha. Eightfold Path.
Yeah. Right concentration and right effort.
Mm-hmm.
They're both in there.
Yeah.
And so you kind of think, well, what does it mean, effort?
Mm.
You know, isn't it just kind of being present? But there is a certain kind of energetic container in a way that you can embody, literally.
Yeah, being upright is a great phrase in that way, that it's a body and mind event, a practice, and they completely go together. And it's like you actually, when your posture, you're feeling that your body is upright, the mind really seems as if it's upright. And so they go together, and then the context of your whole, your conduct in the world in relation to others is upright when the body is upright, and vice versa. So it's not just a random coincidence that we sit upright and, you know, pushing up through gravity. In this non-leaning way. And that is an aspect of taking refuge in Buddha. Being upright when death comes each moment. Let's continue sitting. We dedicate any merit arising from this Dharma gathering to the complete well-being and equanimity of Sobun Catherine Thanis. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.